is within 90 days. So this, of course, does not leave a lot of room for correcting errors or for any sort of attempts to try and get people off of death row. But then there is another system. So this is when, so Israeli occupation that applies in the West Bank will then basically condemn Palestinians to death for offenses that Israel decided are against Israeli security, terror offenses.
But Sarit, if I could just, before we conclude, we have 30 seconds, Sarit. How are human rights groups going to challenge this legislation?
So I would just want to add one important thing, which is that this law actually enshrines, it makes formal a situation where Israelis and Israel are killing Palestinians with impunity in huge numbers. I mean, for the past 2 years, in our genocide of Gaza, in our vast numbers, the vast numbers of Palestinians were also killed in the West Bank. These things have happened with impunity, and the new law that will impose a death penalty is simply making this formalized. However, I think there is also the issue of what this means in terms of Israel's culture, Israeli society's dehumanization of Palestinians. I think this is an example, or this is proof of how low our society has sunk.
Sarit Makaeli, we have to leave it there. I thank you so much for being with us. International Outreach Director at the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem, speaking to us from Tel Aviv. That does it for our show. I am Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Executive Committee meets on the second Thursday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through our public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Clinton Street Theater, a movie theater and community space in Southeast Portland, presenting independent films, live music, theater productions, and more. Information about current screenings is available at cstpdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, more pain for Oregonians as they're paying for their power. The threat of measles shows up at a Portland hospital, and how Pacific Northwest researchers are fighting back against a longer mosquito season. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 2nd, 2026. I'm Minette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Many Oregon residents will be paying quite a bit more for power. As KBOO's Josh Salem tells us, both PGE and Pacific Power just increased their rates.
Residential customers of two of Oregon's largest for-profit electric utilities just saw their bills increase starting yesterday. Portland General Electric residential customers have a 5% increase going forward, which will add about $8 per month to the typical bill. And most Pacific Power residential customer rates will go up 2.9%, or $4.29 a month. It's higher for some Albany customers, who will see a 4.1% increase, or about $5.64 a month on average. That's due to a street remodeling project, which requires Pacific Power to bury power lines underground. Oregon Public Utility Commissioner Chair Letha Tawney said, quote, "Our responsibility is to ensure the lights stay on and service remains safe and reliable as climate change places new and growing pressures on the grid. The Commission carefully evaluates utility spending that supports system hardening and long-term resilience. These adjustments help ensure utilities can maintain the service their customers depend on every day." End quote. Historically, rate hikes were often made at the start of November, but starting this year, companies are prohibited from raising rates during cold winter months, when electric bills are often higher. Of course, this current increase does come at a time when we are seeing markedly increased gas prices due to the war in Iran. For PGE customers, the increase is geared toward funding improvements in the company's distribution system, including substations to carry and transfer energy. The monies will also go to costs associated with the January 2024 winter storm, which caused significant damage and required extensive emergency responses, as well as restoration efforts across the system. PGE claims the rates reflect the actual cost of electricity. The utility says its power costs have tripled over the past 5 years. Pacific Power's needs are similar to PGE's, including power costs, storm-related expenses, and investments in renewable energy. The increases are smaller than they have been in the past. Nonetheless, PGE and Pacific Power customers are paying much more on their energy bills than they did at the start of the pandemic. Some customers are paying 50% more than in 2020. Advocates say there have been record numbers of disconnections in the past 2 years, with more people unable to afford their electric bills. According to utility watchdog group Oregon Citizens Utility Board, in 2024, nearly 70,000 households were behind on their bills and were disconnected by for-profit utilities. Under the FAIR Act, and starting in 2027, utility rate increase requests will be allowed only every 3 years. The law also requires utilities to produce annual reports detailing upcoming rate increases, explaining what rate increases will be for, and analyzing the impact of those increases on their customers. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
As Oregon's mosquito season grows, scientists find out more about what bugs them. A warming climate has extended mosquito season in parts of Oregon by more than a month, and rising populations are growing resistant to common insecticides. As Isabel Shirley reports, in response, scientists have identified a chemical that repels them, along with how mosquitoes detect it, paving the way for more effective repellents.
The threat of rare but deadly disease is rising alongside mosquito populations in the Northwest. In response, scientists are researching how mosquitoes detect a common compound in natural repellents. A warming climate has lengthened mosquito season in the Northwest in some places by over a month. Jeffrey Riffle at the University of Washington says the problem is not just that mosquito populations are increasing, they are also becoming resistant to common insecticides.
These are chemicals like permethrin and others used to control local mosquito populations, or even ones that we spray on ourselves. And so we really need to find ways to prevent mosquitoes.
Riffle says his international team has identified the receptor on mosquitoes' antenna that detects borneol, a chemical used in natural insect repellents. With this information, Riffle plans to identify new chemicals that could be even more repellent to the bugs. He says borneol smells good and is common in many aromatic plants like rosemary. Riffle says the team is also using CRISPR gene editing technology to create genetically modified mosquitoes that cannot detect borneol. He explains that being able to turn off the gene that makes mosquitoes avoid the compound allows them to test how effective it is.
When we do that, we have these mosquito strains that can't smell this borneol repellent. They don't really care anymore, whereas the wild type that we have around us are really highly repelled.
Riffle says this work is timely because with a warming climate, mosquitoes are moving north along with the diseases they carry. He says mosquitoes that carry dengue and Zika virus are already present in California and could be as far north as Seattle in as few as 50 years. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
The Oregon Health Authority says people who visited the emergency waiting room at the Providence Portland Medical Center on Northeast Gleason Street Monday between 7:57 and 10:08 p.m. may have been exposed to measles. If you or your family members were there during that time, contact your doctor. Dr. Don Nolt is a professor of pediatric infectious diseases at OHSU Dornbecker Children's Hospital.
I want to convey 3 points that I convey to my own patient. Measles is very serious, it's very contagious, and the vaccine very safe and really works against protection. And measles is not just a fever and a rash. All children who get measles are absolutely miserable. It can cause serious complications, including pneumonia, and inflammation of the brain known as encephalitis, and in rare instances can cause death. And measles disease poses the highest risk to unvaccinated persons, such as those who are pregnant, infants who are under 1 year of age who really can't get vaccinated, and people with weakened immune system. And it's also very interesting in the past many years that it's understood that measles disease itself can be immunosuppressive and that you can be quite vulnerable to other infections for about 12 months after you suffer through your measles. The second thing I want to tell families after saying that measles is very serious is that it is extremely contagious. Measles spreads through the air, and contagious people can spread measles 4 days even before they have that typical rash. And the virus stays airborne in the area for 2 hours, even when the patient has left that area. So it really is around, not only in the air, but when people cough and sneeze near you. And the third thing I want to remind people in terms of how serious measles is and how contagious it is that vaccinations are so incredibly important, so incredibly protective. It's very safe. It is the best way to protect against measles, particularly if you've had 2 doses, because that is 97% effective. And like all vaccines, the measles-containing vaccine have mild side effects that go away pretty quickly, such as local injection site inflammation and redness and tenderness and fever. The thing that I'd like parents to remember is that this vaccine has been around since the 1960s. And so we have many, many decades of safety data and protective data to show that this is the best way to protect against measles disease. So I recommend all children get 2 doses of the measles-containing vaccine. If you're not sure if you or your child is protected, then talk to your trusted healthcare provider. Measles is here. Measles is on the rise in our area, in Oregon, throughout the United States. And I would encourage parents to reconsider their vaccine decisions.
Last week, health officials confirmed a new measles case linked to a Gresham grocery store. There are at least 11 confirmed cases of measles statewide this year.
We are all under attack.
There is much to talk about, with people speaking out in the Pacific Northwest. Oregon Governor Tina Kotek told the crowd gathered for the No Kings rally in Northeast Portland at the Convention Center Plaza.
Our immigrant and refugee neighbors and co-workers and friends and small business owners, they're under attack, and when they're under attack, we are all under attack. And I want you to know, as your governor, when the federal government says, give us your data, show us your voter data or your health care data to send in ICE raids, I will not yield to those requests.
And that same day, Oregon Secretary of State Tobias Reed spoke to crowds in Beaverton and Tigard.
I will do every single thing in my power to protect your right to vote. I came here for some energy and some optimism in some really dark times, and I want to thank you because you delivered that. I can't wait to see what we do when we continue to roll up our sleeves and protect democracy. Now let's get to it.
And in Gresham, Oregon senior U.S. Senator Ron Wyden led a chanting crowd.
Thank you for joining the effort that began 250 years ago. No King! No! Everybody's getting the drift. What you're doing, that's why we're saying no king from the grassroots. God bless. Let's go. Oregon people in itty-bitty towns to Portland are going to be saying the same. God bless, and once more,
no king!
Let's get it done.
And at another rally in the Dalles, the senator told the people gathering for No King's protests.
So 250 years ago,
seriously, right?
Right!
And all of these things that we're dealing with Trump cutting education in schools wouldn't happen, right?
Right!
I don't want to see Trump's health care premiums because they're going through the roof. So let's make sure we get into every nook and cranny and say,
no kids!
And by the way, when you stop the Iran war, let's stop the Epstein class too. So thanks for coming. It's a gorgeous day. We're going to have some town meetings, but more than anything, political change doesn't start in Washington, D.C. and trickle down. It's grassroots up. That's what you're doing. God bless and...
Rallies like that took place across the country with millions of people participating last Saturday, protesting the Trump administration's policies. It was the third such event under the No Kings name. Oregon's largest event was held in Portland, where police estimate tens of thousands gathered at Waterfront Park for about 2 hours. They marched around downtown. So that was peaceful. However, about an hour after that event ended, Portland police say a crowd gathered in southeast Portland and marched to the ICE facility.
This is the Portland Police Bureau. You shall obey all law and pedestrian control devices. Do not provide to officers with behavior control or targeted arrest. Great crowd control measures, including get back munitions or other physical force, may be used if justified by law. Leave now.
Later that evening, witnesses say they saw people damaging the front gate. While police tried moving crowds away from the building, they say large rocks were thrown at them. At least two people were arrested. Amid that civil unrest, it was civil rights that Oregon Congresswoman Suzanne Bonamici talked about in the nation's capital, warning about what she says is a setback for civil rights in our country in a congressional hearing.
Recently, the GAO published a report about the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights. That's the office that's charged with enforcing civil rights laws that protect more than 70 million students in schools and universities nationwide. Unfortunately, the Trump administration has slashed this office, laid off about half the staff, closed 7 of the 12 regional offices, and then several months later, OCR then recalled about 250 of the laid off staff to address the backlog of civil rights complaints. Reports in January show that OCR failed to meaningfully resolve a single racial harassment or discrimination investigation since Donald Trump took office in January of 2025. Then more than a month ago, 70 of my Democratic colleagues joined me in sending a letter to Secretary McMahon and Assistant Secretary Ritchie. We need answers. We asked about the current number of pending cases and open investigations, how many full-time workers OCR employs, how many remain on paid administrative leave, and whether OCR has resolved any cases related to racial harassment or discrimination of students. We requested answers within 30 days. We have heard nothing. It's been 50 days, no response. Ms. Emery Aris, GAO released a report in January investigating the reduction in force and restructuring at OCR. What effect did the RIFs have on the caseload of the employees who remained at OCR, and what were the circumstances that led to the department recognizing that they needed to reinstate some of those employees?
So as you noted, the department cut about half of the OCR staff during this time, dating back to March. And during this period, from March through September, they had more than 9,000 complaints of alleged discrimination. They opened more than 600 investigations. They reported resolving about 7,000 complaints. And they noted that about 90% of the resolutions were through dismissals.
So they just dismiss the cases rather than resolve them, is what you're saying?
There can be many reasons for dismissals, and the department has not disclosed what those reasons are.
From supplying parts to manufacturing, engineering, and testing, at least 27 Oregon companies and many more throughout the Northwest are part of the team for the Artemis missions.
We are now in full production swing to make engines to support Artemis missions number 5, 6, and subsequent. It's going to be a great time for us.
That's Chris Pereira with L3Harris, a company operating in Redmond, Portland, Salem, and Eugene. Pereira describes working on
new electronic control for in-flight changes as well as thrust levels to have 100% mission success for the Artemis.
He's talking about the engines to power the mission back to the moon. L3 Harris is a major contractor for the Artemis missions. It's providing more than 100 elements for the Artemis II launch.
There's been a lot of process improvements and redesigns, make changes to our powerheads and nozzles as well as many other components for improvement. Our ECU, for example, has allowed us to now have the new electronic control for in-flight changes to mixture ratios as well as thrust levels to have 100% mission success for the Artemis program. Additionally, our 3D printed components have enabled us to reduce the overall count in weld joints, brace joints, as well as many other features that, as a whole, the program, we have had a reduction of over 30% in costs.
Even Oregon's landscape has contributed. NASA tested its spacesuits and practiced exploration at its sites that resemble the moon, such as Lava Butte and Big Obsidian Flow. The Navy ship that recovered the first Artemis 1 capsule from the ocean, the USS Portland, is named after a major Northwest city.
Portland was NASA's at-sea command center for recovery of the Orion space capsule.
That's Captain John Ryan, the commanding officer of the USS Portland, reflecting on that mission and what his crew did in December of 2022.
While not only acting as a planning and communication hub for embarked NASA leadership, Portland conducted flight operations to film the orbital's descent, used our small boats and our vast well deck to retrieve the orbital from the sea, and then transported it back to San Diego. Portland is one of the newest ships in the San Antonio class of LPDs, and it was an ideal platform for supporting this NASA mission. Some of the Portland's unique features include the well deck, which we used to retrieve the orbital from the sea. Portland's significant aviation capability allowed us to embark and employ numerous types of aircraft. We also carried and employed several small boats to bring the orbital into the ship. Additionally, Portland's robust communication suite supported command and control of the mission, and our medical facilities were always available to ensure everyone remained healthy. NASA and the U.S. Navy have a deep history of working together to promote and advance the nation's space program. Artemis 1's recovery allowed NASA and the U.S. Navy to put their years of training into practice to safely recover the orbital. Lessons learned from Artemis 1 recovery will ensure that the subsequent Artemis flights with astronauts on board will be both safe and efficient. Anytime the professionals from NASA and the U.S. Navy can operate together, interoperability is enhanced. The lessons learned from all the classroom training, simulated and real-world practice events, as well as the actual recovery of the Orion orbital, will ensure that the subsequent Artemis flights with astronauts on board will be safe and efficient. In many ways, this mission is a significant reward to the crew after a very busy year, which included returning from an overseas deployment. It's not often that you get to take part in such a history-making event, and Portland was fully prepared and excited to execute. I could not be prouder of the efforts from the crew towards the preparation, training, and execution of this mission.
And that's Captain John Ryan, the commanding officer of the USS Portland, talking about the mission to capture the Artemis 1 spacecraft from the Pacific Ocean and bring it home safely. President Trump justifies his Iran war policy as support among his base plummets. The U.S. Supreme Court appears unlikely to narrow birthright citizenship, and advocates call universities to not use charter flight companies involved in deportations. For some of the stories impacting our democracy, here is today's edition of 2026 Talks.
For these terrorists to have nuclear weapons would be an intolerable threat.
President Donald Trump describes the Iran war as a huge success, vital for American interests. With a primetime White House address, he said the conflict will end in 2 to 3 weeks, saying it is up to other countries to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Since the U.S. began airstrikes, more than a dozen U.S. service members and an estimated 1,600 Iranian civilians have died. The war has shaken markets and sent the average price of gas over $4. In an open letter, Iran's president called on the U.S. to negotiate, calling the confrontation costly and futile. With the war, a declining stock market, and a partial government shutdown, a poll by The Economist finds slightly more than a third of Americans now view Trump favorably. During oral arguments, even conservative Supreme Court justices expressed skepticism on his executive order narrowing birthright citizenship. The administration argued other countries exclude children born to undocumented immigrants or short-term visa holders. Opponents say that runs counter to a century of legal precedent and the 14th Amendment. Justice Brett Kavanaugh was appointed by Trump.
We try to
interpret American law with American precedent based on American history. Why should we be thinking about, gee, European countries don't have this, or many other countries in the world don't have this?
Retired Lieutenant Colonel and former White House National Security Staffer Alexander Vindman has raised more than $8 million in a bid to replace Secretary of State Marco Rubio in the Senate. Vindman testified against Trump during his first impeachment and hopes to follow several Democrats who have flipped seats in Florida this year. Residents of rural downstate Illinois are joining those in other states resisting local data center projects, questioning their environmental impacts and energy usage. Lori McKiernan with the Coalition for Springfield's Utility Future says,
I'm not against data centers, but I must say the more I learn about them, the more concerned I am. And I want our county board to do their due diligence to address all of these concerns.
Illinois state lawmakers are debating a suite of new regulations on data centers this legislative session. That includes the Power Act, which would require them to use clean energy, cover infrastructure costs, and disclose water or environmental impacts. As colleges compete in March Madness, a union is calling on the NCAA to end partnerships with charter flight companies that also transport detained immigrants. Casey Helton with SEIU says last fall, the service employees launched the De-Ice These Flights campaign to pressure universities.
The way that you answer these corporations that are profiting off of hate and suffering is you hit them in their wallets. You go after this invisible hand of capital that is like driving this whole profit framework around these deportations.
I'm Simone Perez.
California has launched multiple initiatives trying to bring up the percentage of Californians who have a college degree, credential, or certificate to meet the state's goal of 70% by 2030. Suzanne Potter has that story.
Right now, 56% of Californians from ages 25 to 64 have earned a college degree, credential, or certificate, but that's well short of the goal set by Governor Gavin Newsom of 70% college attainment by the year 2030. A new report from the Campaign for College Opportunity lays out a plan to support more students as they pursue their dreams. Jesse Ryan, president of the campaign, says California needs well-educated workers to sustain the economy, which is now the fourth largest in the world.
And we also will not meet that 70% attainment goal if we don't do a better job on delivering better results for our Latinx students, our Black students, our low-income students, and our first-generation students.
The state created the California Education Interagency Council to make sure that leaders from the public school system, community colleges, and four-year colleges create seamless pathways to degrees and certificates that match workforce needs. The Cal State schools are now proactively offering admission to students who qualify without them having to apply. Programs called Associate Degrees for Transfer have funneled 630,000 students into four-year institutions. 6.4 million Californians currently have some college credits, but no degree. Ryan says the state will need 1.3 million additional educated adults to meet its goals.
It's not just about ensuring that tuition is affordable. It's about making sure that we are removing the barriers of the total cost of attendance.
The report also praises dual enrollment programs that allow students in 9th through 12th grades to get college credit while still in high school. I'm Suzanne Potter.
White Horse becomes the first Native rider to win the Ty Murray Invitational. And the public comment period ends for Safari Club International Proposals. Here's Jill Freitas with National Native News.
Over the weekend, a Diné Pro athlete from the Arizona Ridge Riders ascended to the top ranks of competitive bull riding worldwide. KJZZ's Gabriel Piatavrazio has more.
Keyshawn just crafted his career moment, and he perches above them all and is the master of the pit.
For the first time, Keyshawn Whitehorse won the Ty Murray Invitational, after hanging on to a bucking bull named Lights Out. The 28-year-old had a perfect record, going 4-for-4 on his rides, and pretty much everybody in the building was right behind him.
Navajo Nation, the support here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I dreamed of this moment in my entire life, and now we're on track for a gold buckle. This is a great stepping stone.
White Horse is now among the top 10 riders in the world. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Piatrazio.
Alaska Native groups have scrambled to make their voices heard on a series of subsistence proposals from Safari Club International, which aims to reshape fish and game management on federal lands. By the time the deadline for public comment passed on Monday, more than 2,000 people had weighed in. Rhonda McBride from our flagship station in Anchorage reports.
The letters are emotional, overwhelmingly, from rural hunters and fishers worried that the Safari Club's proposals to the U.S. Interior Department threaten their ability to live off the land. Tribal leaders like Gayla Hossett say these battles never seem to end.
We're oftentimes repeating ourselves over and over.
This time, Native groups are facing off against one of the most powerful sport hunting advocacy groups in the nation, which seeks to overturn Biden administration policies that added three tribally nominated seats to the Federal Subsistence Board. The Safari Club also wants to remove three other public seats and return the board to its original makeup, limited to the heads of five federal agencies.
It's a revolving door of these regional administrators that come through our state and that are here for a time, and they're making management decisions not really knowing being on the land.
As a senior advisor to Interior Secretary Deb Haaland during the Biden administration, Raina Thiel shepherded the process of adding the additional tribal seats. Although it took about 3.5 years to get them in place, Thiel says it was worth the effort. Along the way, tribal leaders introduced many ideas on how to improve subsistence management on federal lands.
Nobody really lives the way we live in Alaska. It's an incredibly unique system. And so folks just don't have the context or the history with it to really understand it.
The Safari Club has also called on federal managers to defer to the state when overseeing wildlife on federal land. But opponents say that conflicts with a 1980 law which gives rural Alaskans priority for hunting and fishing on federal lands.
The word deference means consideration. It's not mandate.
John Sturgeon, a longtime Alaska Safari Club policymaker, says the group does not oppose rural priority.
We're not asking for that. We're saying that they have to listen to fish and game, and we don't think they've been doing that over the years.
Alaska's dual management system for state and federal lands has spawned many a battle over the right to hunt and fish, and this one could be the start of another long fight. In Anchorage,